Okay, so our next speaker is Alan Hunt Bediner, talking about catching the buzz, drugs or dharma. And again, that sort of duality thing that I'm hoping we can sort of transcend or integrate here today and tomorrow. Again, I'm not going to read the abstracts here because, first of all, they're in the program, and I want to talk about the people themselves. Alan is a writer and activist who's been writing in the area of Buddhism, ecology, and psychedelics for many years. This is a man who is actually implementing, taking action on some of the wonderful sort of mystical insights or nature mysticism or integrative sort of ecological feelings that we often get on psychedelics. This is a man who's moving forward on it, who's taking action. How Buddhism relates to modern social problems. He's a contributing editor at Tricycle Magazine, serves on the board of directors of Rainforest Action Network. He edited the book Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, with Alex Gray, doing the artwork, for Chronicle Books in 2002, as well as two other books of collected essays, Dharma Gaia, A Harvest in Buddhism and Ecology, which I think had an introduction by the Dalai Lama? Yes. And so, this is the real deal, very integrated into society, into making things real, and also into the usefulness of psychedelics. His other collected essay book is Mindfulness in the Marketplace, Compassionate Responses to Consumerism. His new book currently in the works is called Buddhaland, The Eight Great Places of Pilgrimage in India. Alan has got a master's degree in Buddhist Studies from the College of Buddhist Studies in LA, and is an adjunct professor currently teaching at CIIS, California Institute for Integral Studies, in San Francisco. So I'm going to turn you over to the very, very capable hands of Alan Hunt Bediner. Alan?
Well, it's a little daunting to follow Daniel Pinchback, but somebody has to do it. First, I'd like to express my appreciation and gratitude to Kevin Bauchtick for manifesting this extraordinary event, and to Neil Goldsmith for including me, and to all the other speakers and the staff and all the volunteers and the people that made this gathering today possible. My own qualifications, how's the sound? Is it okay? In the back? Okay. My own qualifications for speaking before you today, I'd say, pale in comparison to the esteemed and prominent researchers in this field that make up most of the rest of the schedule. Even in terms of personal field experience, I am decidedly a neophyte. I'm curious, will all those who have not taken LSD dare to raise your hands at this moment? Thank you. I always think I'm the only one. That's great. Actually, for my part, there have been a fair number of journeys with the mushroom teacher, other plant teachers, some interesting vine time with Terence McKenna and his botanical dimension, and some experience with the entheogens, the newer class of entheogens as popularized by Sasha and Ann Shulgin and others. But the points that I'd like to make here today derive more from the academic experience of compiling a book about Buddhism and psychedelics that Neil referred to called Zigzag Zen, for which Alex Gray created some of the most compelling and beautiful psychedelic art. I don't know if Alex is here, but thank you again, Alex. It's been 6 years since Zigzag Zen was released. It was based largely on a special section which I edited in Tricycle Magazine in the fall of 1996. The book was published by Chronicle Books in 2002, and it was really the first, I think, of its kind to examine the relationship between Buddhism and psychedelics through a variety of voices and perspectives. Each of the 33 contributors had different stories to tell, different circumstances, different substances, different lessons to draw from. For some, it was a story about giving into temptation, suffering a lack of clarity, or worse, lasting confusion and addiction. For others, it was a brief glimpse into a rarefied world of intense sense impressions and, you know, fanciful imagery. For others still, it was a breakthrough, an arrival at the threshold of what the Buddha's teachings were really about, with unforgettable, if in some cases fleeting, insights. All the contributors had a significant story to tell, and each person's facet of the truth of drugs and Dharma remain riveting and revealing. My 20-year fascination with Buddhism is primarily about how it shows up in the modern world, how it informs the challenges of modern life and our social struggles. My earlier books on Buddhism focus on Buddhism in relation to economics and globalization, which I think is due for an update after the events of the last week, and Buddhism and the ecological crisis. But why psychedelics? Certainly the use and abuse of drugs are a giant social and legal problem, created, of course, mainly by people who think it's a problem, and in some cases who want it to be a problem. Certainly the structures and thinking in place to control drug use in our society drive the lion's share of most of the inappropriate use and abuse. While psychedelics definitely lurk in the backgrounds of and the histories of most first-generation Buddhist teachers in America and in Europe, actually a side note on that, when I was putting together Zigzag Zen, I failed to find one teacher who did not have a psychedelic history. I did find one, but then someone told me later that they were covering it up. But today we find many of these same teachers advising against this path that they once traveled. The fifth precept, the Buddhist admonition against drinking intoxicating liquors, is frequently touted as the end of conversation about the possibility of using psychedelics, regardless of the sincerity or intensity of the higher purpose that motivates such a journey. In fact, the intentional use of consciousness-expanding psychedelics for personal growth purposes has very little to do with, say, for example, imbibing a bottle of gin. Buddhism and psychedelics share a great deal in common, an acute attraction to mindfulness, an appreciation for present moment awareness, and the primacy of direct experience. In their purest applications, they share the same ultimate purpose, the attainment of liberation for the mind. Few Buddhists make the claim that psychedelic use is a path itself. Some maintain that it's a legitimate gateway, and others, acutely aware of the inconvenient duality of any chemically dependent spiritual pursuit, feel that Buddhism and psychedelics don't mix at all. But just as Buddhism itself, according to its founder, must be held to the test of personal experience and to the wholesomeness or unwholesomeness of the results personally felt, so also must the question of how or if psychedelics can be a part of Dharma practice. Buddhism is a path of freedom, the Visuddhimagga, as it's known in the Pali language, and so we are all free. In fact, we must be free to make these choices for ourselves. Encouraging critical examination and analysis and the freedom to make discoveries for oneself is an essential foundation of Buddhism, and it's found as far back as the Kalama Sutra. The Kalamas lived in an area of northwest India called Kasaputa during the time of the Buddha, and they were primarily of the merchant class. The Buddha was advising them on how to verify what is true, and I think the Buddha's advice to them bears some quoting in a little detail here. He said, "Do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in scripture, nor upon one's surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon logical reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, or another's seemingly keen mind, nor upon consideration that this monk is our teacher." The Buddha warned the Kalamas, "Only when you yourselves know in your experience that these things are good, that these things are not blamable, that these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed to lead to benefit and happiness in you, should you abide in them." Just as social prohibitions on what ideas to let into your consciousness are an anathema in Buddhism, so must be the restrictions on what plants to let in. Tibetan Buddhists, for one, have developed over the centuries a wide field of psychopharmacology and have an endless number of psychiatric botanical medicines, practically none of which have been previously identified or scientifically studied in the West. When I use the term psychedelics, also called entheogens, which, despite my essentially agnostic Buddhist perspective, is an accepted word, I am referring to the use of plant materials that expand consciousness and trigger primary spiritual experience. The problems caused by cocaine, heroin, GHB, ketamine, methamphetamines, and other consciousness-constricting drugs are indisputable, and as far as I'm concerned, undefendable. And I'm sure there's several who have in the room that have an argument with that. The notion that all drugs are fundamentally alike is really at the root of our confusion in our drug laws and in the social debate about them. Drugs differ. Uses and occasions differ. Policies and practices ought to differ appropriately. Drug use will always be with us. So therefore, it seems reasonable that recreational users of psychedelics, who are also responsible users, should be treated more or less the same as recreational drinkers are. Medical users of marijuana should be treated the same, or of psychedelics rather, should be treated the same as anyone using commercial psychopharmaceuticals for their health. Spiritual users of psychedelics should be respected as any seekers of greater wisdom and shifts, people desiring wisdom and greater shifts in consciousness. Too slowly, we are collectively grasping the reality that abuse of drugs, of dangerous drugs, is less of a legal issue and more of a medical one. Psychedelics used as a sacrament is well known throughout history, but it's interesting how at this time it's intersecting with Buddhism, both of which are at the base of a massive and burgeoning human quest for greater understanding of the self. Until just the very recent past, awareness about the deepest occult or hidden parts of our spirit selves were considered the private preserve of shamans and priests and people who had earned access to it. Religious experience was mediated by these authorized few, and this is a tradition still with us in form, if not in attitude, of most of the religions that we find to this day. The democratization of psychedelics, however, and of Buddhism to some extent, has been very much about the breakdown of this restricted access to the divine. In Buddhism, as well as in psychedelics, the individual takes responsibility for their relationship to the source of their being and for access to the highest states of the spirit mind. Awareness of the relatedness between people and between objects, and particularly the intimate understanding of the interrelated nature of opposites, are among the key insights psychedelic travelers often bring home from their plant-assisted pilgrimages. Perhaps the popularization of both Zen and psychedelics have had a major role in shifting the cultural mind from the Cartesian linear view of reality towards a mode of awareness that's more ecological and holistic. While we will always continue to think in linear ways, awareness is growing that it is a relative human construct and not a reflection of some objective reality out there. This way of seeing is not something people necessarily need psychedelics to experience. It is, in fact, one of the central premises underlying Zen and its doctrine of non-duality. But this emergent worldview brings us closer to a perspective that is perhaps equally comfortable being called dharmic or psychedelic. Putting aside the myriad well-founded arguments both for and against psychedelic use, there is an essential Buddhist response to the long entrenched, ongoing, devastating so-called war on drugs, and that is great compassion. I'd like to highlight this issue a little more. Draconian drug laws ensnare, as you know, millions of otherwise law-abiding people in a growing spiral of wasteful and counterproductive strategies, the foundation for which is punishment. It's resulted in an incarceration rate so unimaginable that 1 out of 5 human beings behind bars in the world is in the United States. At this very moment, American jails and prisons hold tens of thousands of people, vastly disproportionate numbers of them black, whose only crime is the possession of a plant. Prisons become classrooms for more advanced crime. Drugs are readily available to anyone from school children on up. Criminals outspend and outsmart police, and no one feels safer. The drug war has led to cynicism and apathy, and of course continues to blight thousands of lives. Profits from the illegal drug trade has fueled organized crime and enhanced the power of cartels to corrupt judges and police and government officials. The latest casualty in the failed war on drugs is our personal liberties. A society that actively banishes personal exploration with all psychedelic plants will need to monitor closely all of its citizens. All of our communications, transactions, and expressions are under increasing surveillance by a growing and expensive bureaucracy of control and repression. None of this is conducive to the peaceful, free contemplation of strategies for our personal liberation and fulfillment. In reality, this ceases to be a war on drugs, but rather is a war on consciousness, a war on the free exercise of the most precious gifts bestowed on human beings. Human history can arguably be seen as a series of relationships with plants, relationships made and relationships broken. Plants, drugs, politics, and religions harshly intermingled, from the influence of sugar on mercantilism to the influence of coffee on the modern office worker, from the British forcing opium on the Taoist Chinese to credible reports that the CIA used heroin in the ghetto to choke off dissent and dissatisfaction. The lessons to be learned can be raised into consciousness, integrated into social policy, and used to create a more caring and meaningful world, or they can be denied, with the results now plainly seen. The enhanced capacity for vastly enhanced cognitive experience that are made possible by the use of psychedelic plants, I think, are as basic a part of our humanity as spirituality or even our sexuality. The question is, how quickly can we evolve in our collective maturity sufficiently so as to have an informed and balanced conversation and examination of these issues? As the eminent thinker Houston Smith was fond of pointing out, while psychedelic use is all about altered states, Buddhism is all about altered traits, and one does not necessarily lead to the other, although it often does. One Theravada monk likened the mind on psychedelics to the image of a tree whose branches are overladen with low-hanging, heavy fruit. The danger is that the heavy fruit, too rich and full to be fully digested by the tree all at once, will weigh down the branches and cause them to snap. On the other hand, Alan Watts, one of the first prominent Westerners to follow the Buddhist path, considered both Buddhism and psychedelics to be part of an ideal individual philosophical quest. He was not interested in Buddhism to be studied and defined in such a way that mixing it up with other interests and disciplines such as quantum theory or gestalt psychology or aesthetics or most certainly psychedelics. One time when Alan Watts was giving a seminar at Esalen Institute, one seminarian asked him, "What do you think is the best path to enlightenment? A lot of meditation or taking psychedelics?" And he chuckled thoughtfully and he said to himself, "Well, I don't know about a best way, but perhaps you could think of it like this. You can fly on a jet plane to New York, or you can walk." While it is clear that Buddhism and psychedelics inform each other, their intersection also makes room for much confusion. We ought to continue to have this conversation. It's only when we have the courage, I think, to see the truth in the other voices that we recognize the deepest and fullest reflection of what is relatively real in our own. I think I'll stop here and devote the balance of the time for questions and comments, if they're kept short, and criticisms as well. Thank you. Yes.
Sorry, the infallible.
The Roman Catholic Church.
The role of the church. Well, it's, you know, the church is a huge institution, and it manifests on many levels in many ways, some very progressive and very helpful, and some, of course, very repressive and unhelpful. I think to the extent that those levels of the church that are functioning in a helpful way, I think they will be part of a progression of human spirituality and human evolution. For the rest of the church, we're going to have to grin and bear it. I don't know what else to say. Yes. Well, I think that's, I wouldn't characterize that as a danger as much as a, I think the question was that he had heard that, or understood that there was a possible danger to meditators taking psychedelics, because then it would result in their expectation of having an altered state in their meditations. Was that correct? Creating a state to seek, to anticipate in their meditations. I think that, it's a hard undertaking to enter into a meditative state or have the desire to enter into a meditative state without expecting some kind of state change. I think that's something that we're looking for when we go into meditation or in most cases in taking psychedelics. There is a subtle difference between expecting or anticipating an altered state and feeling the need to escape the state that you're in or fully accept and fully experience the actual reality that you are in, which I think is pretty mystical as it is if we open our eyes to what's really going on around us. I think it's a subtle difference, and I'm not sure that I would call that a problem. I think it's really the effort to take psychedelics, to meditate, to do anything one can do to evolve as part of our impulse to cultivate ourselves includes that anticipation. I don't think it's a bad thing. Yes. The question was to talk a little bit about the integration of the post-psychedelic experience, or taking the lessons of the psychedelic experience into your daily life or into your meditations. Or okay. Well, I think that if you have a useful psychedelic experience, on the other hand, if you have a useful meditative experience, it's going to be difficult to not bring that into your daily life. It's going to integrate itself into your daily life. I don't think that there's a particular method or strategy for doing that. I think it's part of the process itself, and it will manifest in your experience of your daily life without your having to do anything. That's my experience, and that's all I can go on. Thank you. Yes. I didn't hear the name of the person that advanced the theory. Rick Strassman. Okay, well, very respected psychedelic researcher. And if I'm paraphrasing your question right, it's that his idea is that you are actually, in deep meditation, you are manifesting some of the changes in the brain and the consciousness that you would also experience under psychedelics, so that you don't have to take psychedelics to have these experiences. Is that what you're saying? I totally agree. Yes. How do I see what happening again? Ah, okay. Well, that's assuming that that we're expecting our national leaders and politicians at that level to make a difference in that evolution. I'm not necessarily convinced that that's where the change is coming from. You know, there's the old adage that change comes from the bottom up, and certainly in the area of psychedelics and understanding and a spread of the psychedelic perspective, that's almost definitely true. We're not going to be expecting Barack Obama, as much as I am so excited about his candidacy, for him to get up and start talking about how we should teach psychedelics in grade school, et cetera. So the psychedelic perspective will manifest despite who's occupying in the White House, and I hope it is Barack Obama, so anyway. yes, in the back there. So you all heard the question then better than I did. That's great. I think what the questioner was asking is, when you take that jet plane, when you take psychedelics, are you leaving something behind? Is there some part of your biological process that is short-circuited or in some way left in a detrimental state as a result of that? I haven't noticed that. I mean, you could make that argument. There are people who use, or I guess arguably abuse psychedelics and look like they're having some problems with their feet on the ground and their biological system adapting to reality. And there are people who don't take psychedelic drugs who have those problems. So I'm really not sure that there's been any convincing evidence that taking psychedelics somehow causes harm on any level. There are anecdotal stories about people jumping out of windows and things like that, but you know, people are doing that with or without psychedelics. So I'm not sure that I could say, I'm not ruling it out. I can't be in a position to do that, but I have no reason to believe that that's true. Sorry? Okay, well, I'm sure that that's true. There's a benefit, there's a cost-benefit scenario for every action or every thought, for that matter. So, you know, what that is and whether it's been quantified or whether it's a cost to the extent that we would not want to go there, I have not seen that evidence. So, let's see, in the way in the back over there. That's a really important point. If I heard correctly, she was talking about the importance, the value of community to not only enhance, but to make the psychedelic experience a valuable one and a useful one, not only to oneself, but to the society around one. So I think that a lot of the questions about how do you integrate your experience in your psychedelic experience and how do you bring it into your daily life, a lot of that is about community, about how you share your set and setting and what lessons you can draw and share and learn from other people in your life. And then we are social beings, and so there has to be a social process of evolution and enlightenment. Yes. How would you characterize the The question is, how would I characterize the Buddhist community's attitude or response since my book and in relation to my book at the present time? It's interesting because when I was compiling this book and doing interviews and collecting essays from various people in the Buddhist world, I was anticipating, in fact, I was hoping for a great deal of controversy to erupt from this book and that there'd be people getting up and condemning me and all this stuff, and I just thought, good, bring it on. But the Buddhists were kind of like, okay, you know. I mean, there was very little... I think it has to do with the closeted psychedelic background of most, or if not all, of the teachers, as well as a great numbers of the students as well. And so it was like, yeah, I've been there, but I don't want to talk about that now. So that sort of didn't manifest, but it was in the ether. It was in the air. I mean, people knew that this was an issue. And for God's sakes, I mean, culturally speaking, whether it's Allen Ginsberg or, I mean, any number of characters who represented in their being and in their teachings the bringing together of Buddhism and psychedelics, and it was never talked about, never written about. So it was just high time it was, and people sort of took it as sort of, okay, about time, next, you know. And I think that's the attitude now, too, is because for quite a few people, there is this bias, Buddhists rather, there is this bias against psychedelics now, that we've been there and done that, now we have to sit very calmly and center ourselves in. And I think that's helpful, but to deny what it is that prompted you to that impulse, or what you brought you to the door of the Zendo, is ridiculous. So there's value in all of it, and if it's integrated and looked at in a less dual way, I think it's more serving. Yes? What's bad about, I knew that question was gonna come. What's bad about cocaine? For me personally, you have to peel me off the ceiling if I take it. I don't, it's a problem for me, but I'm not generalizing from my experience to all humanity. I think that, that's a good question. I don't have the answer, really. I think there are some recent studies. I think it's Ronald Siegel at UCLA that came out with quite a shocking study looking at the evidence of... he was looking at heart attack rates since the popularization of cocaine, and looking at data and drawing a very convincing correlation with data about people who had heart attacks with no previous heart condition and those that used and didn't use cocaine. And he drew a very convincing correlation between cocaine use and heart attacks. If you're fond of using it, I think you should look into that work. I put it in the category of a consciousness constricting material, but it's not entirely true because it does, like all these things, there are elements of cocaine experience that is very expansive and people can become much more sharp and aware and whatever, but I think something gets left out of their awareness, and I think on the whole my experience of it is and my judgment that it's a consciousness constricting material as opposed to an expansive one. So especially in terms of the whole picture, the heart space, mental capacity, empathy, all of those issues. You might feel brighter and sharper, but you might be meaner and less compassionate. Yes? Well, that's interesting. The question was, in doing the research for Zigzag Zen, what have I discovered about why many of the Buddhist teachers that previously used stopped using, or Buddhist students or whatever? I think, I didn't really come up with a strong set of examples in each case. My own instinctual response to that question is that as a continuous path, it requires a braver soul than I have to be using psychedelics on a regular basis, on a constant basis, to arrive at my own evolutionary goals. And to use it as a gateway or a way to from time to time, check in on my real progress or to stimulate further evolution is somehow, in my experience, and I think in extrapolating from many interviews, kind of the experience that many people have had, is a more effective use of psychedelics than sort of a daily, weekly practice of taking psychedelics. So that's just off the cuff, but that's how I'd respond to that. Yes? The questioner was referring to the Makyo experience that in the Zen tradition, particularly the Japanese Zen tradition, taking psychedelics or having these breakthroughs and insights from psychedelics is a state that sometimes can be mimicked in your meditative experience, and that one should disregard that. Well, I don't know how easily you can disregard that. I don't even know if you should disregard it. And Buddhism comes in a variety of ethnic envelopes, and all of them have their own baggage. And I think that that's part of Japanese Zen baggage, of which there's quite a bit. The teachers really are very strict in Zen, and that's good in one sense. But in another sense, if it's something outside their experience, they're leaving out something that's very helpful and can serve us. I don't buy that theory at all, and I think that, as I said, that's something really hard to identify, and it's also pretty hard to do. So I would disregard that. Yes. The question was saying if you're encountering law enforcement or the authorities, like you're caught for taking psychedelics or having them, that one should use the spiritual excuse that this is this is my religion, officer. And how do I answer that one? I'm sure they're going to go really accept that and just say, well, next time be more careful, you know. That's a tough one, because there are members of the law enforcement community that would, respect a person if they felt they were sincere, that this is something I'm doing for my personal evolution, that something, it's a religious act for me, officer, and I'm sorry I'm driving while I'm doing it, but, you know. But I think there's most of them wouldn't, and... in my personal experience, I would have trouble even bringing that side of what is sacred in that experience to their attention. It would somehow pollute it for me to even have him thinking about it in that sense. So I would just go, oh, I'm bad luck, I'm whatever, and then just keep my mouth shut, I suppose, and just pay my fine or whatever. In the future, I think that hopefully we won't have to grin and bear it. We'll be able to make a very strong case, because there's a lot of evidence for it, that it is a useful thing to do, and it's a helpful thing in society, and there'll be more respect for it, and people won't be automatically criminalized for using it. Any other? Yes. Well, as you might be able to surmise, I'm not an expert on cocaine at all. But the questioner was saying that he understood that there might be evidence for using cocaine. One of the reasons cocaine can be such a negative experience or potentially a negative experience is that you're taking something, you're ripping out of the natural plant some aspect of it or some form of it, and then you're not getting the full benefit of the plant, and therefore you're setting yourself up for a bad experience, possibly. Is that more? Sorry, was that a question back there? Or just a random comment? Okay, I didn't hear it, so. Yes. Yeah, so I imagine you all heard that, and it's true. I mean, I think it's a hard argument to make because we have the right, and in fact, we must edit our environment for nutrition, for energy, for many things. We derive elements from one thing from another, and so just the separation of taking something from the cocoa plant is not necessarily what makes it a bad trip. I would say that that'd be a hard argument to make, but it's interesting. It's not an area of my expertise. So I think one more question, if there is one. Yes. Well, that's a nice question. I'm a father, and I have a daughter, and the questioner knows that. And she's asking how, as a parent, I relate to Buddhism and psychedelics to her, how I describe it to her, how I describe it to her. Is that what you were saying? Yeah. I don't. No. She knew. No, it's a joke, okay? she. Well, mostly a joke. She was quite young, younger when she's 16 now, and so she has lots of questions about this. And I think it's really important as a parent and also as a responsible member of society to be honest, not necessarily with law enforcement, but you know, to be honest with people, particularly your family, about why you see a value in exploring psychedelics and why it's important to you. And when you share that, you know, from your heart and from your highest sense of being, I think that people really get that message. And that's a message that we really have to have the courage to tell others, and including our children. I think you have to be careful how you tell your children and what you tell them, and at what level and at what age that it's appropriate. But nevertheless, I think they're going to get from the spirit of what you're talking about what they need to get, and you should be free and feel the courage to do that. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.